Thank you, everyone, and welcome again to the ADA Audio Conference Series. We're happy that you're able to join us today for this very important session. This program is brought to you as a collaboration between the ADA National Network and the Great Lakes ADA Center. We hope that you are going to find today's session to be a valuable one. People are connected in a variety of different ways today. Some people are on the telephone. Some people are using both telephone and the webinar platform. Others are just using the webinar platform. Real-time captioning is available via the webinar platform. We will take your questions today and do welcome your questions throughout the session. So if you're by telephone, just hold your question, and when we're ready to take them, we will give instructions for you as to how to go ahead and ask your question. In the meantime, those of you that are in the webinar platform, feel free to enter your questions in the chat area. It is not seen by anybody else other than the speakers, so you don't have to worry about that. But you also have the option, as was explained earlier in the slides, to send us an email with your questions as well at info@ada-audio.org. You can send us an email, and we're happy to take your questions by email as well. We'll feed them to our presenter at the end, who is more than happy also to respond to your questions. We're pleased to have today's session, which is going to focus on ADA self-evaluation and transition plan, specifically looking at some of the things to keep in mind to make sure that you have the correct content and that it is, as our speaker has cleverly named it, seasoned with the right ingredients. Are you covering the right issues? Are there things missing and things you haven't thought about in that process? We're thrilled to have Jennifer Skulski speaking with us today. Jennifer has a varied background. Her bio is available on the website, so I won't spend a lot of time going through that. But for those of you who may or may not know, Jennifer used to work here at the Great Lakes ADA Center. She was a member of the staff here for a couple of years. She also was at the National Center on Accessibility, located at Indiana University as well, and has an extensive experience as a consultant and providing training on the Americans with Disabilities Act with a specific emphasis on looking at the issues of self-evaluation and transition planning. She now is the principal in the Skulski Consulting and works across the country, even though she's located in Indiana. But she works many different areas across the country. She also puts out a newsletter on a regular basis that covers some of the key topics in this particular area and might be of interest to you. And she's provided that information both on a cover slide and a later slide today that we'll review that has her contact information. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn the microphone over to Jennifer so she can begin with the content of the presentation. And again, remind you to please feel free to submit questions throughout the process, and we'll make sure that those get fed to our presenter during the Q&A period. So Jennifer, at this time, I'm going to turn the microphone over to you.
Great. Thanks, Robin. Thank you so much for the invitation to join you all today. It's exciting to know that there's people from across the country that are dialing in or coming in on the website and being able to connect us and bring us together to talk on this topic. I know for myself, over the last 20 years, it's been pretty confusing talking about self-evaluations and transition plans. So I appreciate the opportunity to share the information that I've learned over the years with all of you and how you can go about doing what you do best even better when it comes to ADA compliance. So with that, I just want to kind of give you a little background. As Robin mentioned, I started out with my hometown park district way back after the ADA was passed, before there was an internet, and I had to find all of my resources the hard way. I remember calling in to Robin at the Great Lakes ADA Center and getting pages of the ADA and the standards faxed to me on an unneeded basis. So at one point in time, finally, I think I got the whole entire set of regulations. But one of the challenging parts of my job starting out as an ADA coordinator was putting together our self-evaluation and pretty much our action plan for in terms of what we were going to do, bridging the self-evaluation and the transition plan. And so as I moved into different roles in technical assistance, both at the Great Lakes ADA Center and then as a consultant, I would get a lot of questions from people. What does a transition plan look like? What does a self-evaluation plan look like? And as more and more entities started putting their documents up on the web, I would kind of, you know, do a search every so often and try to keep a pool, you know, a good sample of those different documents. But over the last few years, and I would say probably about the last 8 or 9 years in particular, it was getting really frustrated. And,
Jennifer, I need to put you on a hold for a minute. We've lost our captioner for a second here.
Oh, okay, no problem.
Not quite sure. I see you're still in the room, but I'm not quite sure.
I was talking so fast I burned up the
keyboard.
That's
okay. Just do a test with the captioner to see if she's back in and we're able to hear us at this time. Captioner, are you able? Not seeing captions yet. Oh, there we go. Okay, I believe our captioner is back with us.
Okay. All right.
Sorry about that. Go ahead.
No problem. So just to recap before I talk a little bit more about that frustration between the self-evaluation and the transition plan, but so if you go back to Title II, I just want to recap on the administrative requirements because we're going to talk about these throughout the session, is that you had kind of those four or five, depending on the size of your entity, core administrative requirements under Title II to designate a responsible employee, to provide a notice to the public, to establish a grievance procedure, to conduct a self-evaluation, and to put together a transition plan. And I'm going to be talking about those individually as we move along. But I want to get back to my frustration. So probably within the last 10 years or that, and again, as more and more of the self-evaluations and transition plans were being put online, I would do a search every once in a while just to have a good pool so that if people had, you know, questions, I could kind of give them examples of different documents to look to. But what started happening was that in those searches, I would find a lot of documents that were labeled as ADA self-evaluations, and they really only dealt with physical access to the buildings or facilities for the entity. They really didn't have to do anything with policy and procedure. And so it was very frustrating, especially when people are asking me, what does the self-evaluation look like? And they can do all these web searches to find the keywords, self-evaluation in the documents, but the documents in no way, shape, or form are actually addressing the policy and procedures that might have needed to be modified or how agencies went about modifying those procedures in order to really serve as good examples to other entities out in the field. And so I kind of equate that to this analogy between parsley and cilantro, is that they both look a lot alike on face value. However, if you've ever gotten bitten into something that you thought was parsley and gotten a big surprise to find out it was cilantro, there's a huge difference between the two. And that was kind of my surprise in doing these searches, was that, you know, they're all claiming to be documents that are self-evaluations, and they really don't cover the essential data that needs to be covered in a self-evaluation. And so if there's any point I want to get across to you today is, please don't confuse your parsley and cilantro. Your self-evaluation is completely, entirely different from your ADA transition plan. And hopefully when we go through the content here, you'll get a better understanding of the differences between the two. So if we go back to the regulations, essentially Title II requires that you conduct an internal self-evaluation, that you review your policies, practices, and procedures, and identify where any of those may screen out, either intentionally or unintentionally, screen out people with disabilities. And if they do that, or if they prohibit participation or access to any of your program services or activities, modifications should be put into place with those policies, practices, and procedures. So basically, it's looking at how do you do business? How do you provide your services, programs, and activities? And how might those standard operating procedures or those policies need to be modified to ensure people with disabilities can participate? Completely different from a transition plan, and this is where people start to interchange the two terms without fully understanding the difference between the two. So the transition plan is really looking at where your program services and activities are conducted and whether or not there are any structural or communication barriers that exist there and how those should be removed, a schedule for the removal of those so that people with disabilities can access the supporting facilities where those program services and activities take place. So if you have a building that has stairs into it and people can go get their driver's license there, or they can come to listen to a public lecture and the structure itself is not accessible, what is your time frame for removing the barrier there and making it accessible for people with disabilities? So those are two completely different approaches to accessibility for people with disabilities over and more overarching concept that I call the ADA action plan, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. So if we go back to those core administrative requirements, that first one is designating a responsible employee. And I go back to these core administrative requirements because in order to conduct the self-evaluation and transition plan, it's going to be key that you know who that responsible employee is. Now, the ADA itself does not use the term ADA coordinator. It says it's a designated responsible employee. And so I've worked with a lot of different agencies over the years, and they have different approaches. Some entities might call it an ADA coordinator, and that person is the final decision maker when there are issues, whether or not it's modification of a policy, practice, or procedure, or a grievance comes about that has to be decided upon. Others have designated a director, a deputy director, a CEO, the top ranking official as the designated responsible employee. And so I think it's really important for you as an entity to decide, do you have an ADA coordinator that is going to kind of implement the day-to-day operation of or implementation of the self-evaluation and transition plan? At what decision-making authority does that person have? Or do you need to also designate who that final decision maker is within the entity? That responsible employee, they should be the public liaison. So you might end up breaking that up a bit between what the ADA coordinator does and what the CEO might do. And over the course of the years, we've kind of seen how the originating department for the ADA coordinator has evolved. Originally, I think a lot of entities were putting it in human resources because there was so much that had to do with employment. And then once they completed their transition plan and recognizing how much physical improvements to facilities needed to be done, it would move into planning or design or operations. And then I think more of a balance that we've seen over the last couple of years is moving the ADA coordinator role along the lines of a safety coordinator or risk manager. And what I've seen happen in the last 3 or 4 years, a lot more ADA coordinators in the role of community engagement. So it just is kind of a matter of where to, what's the best fit for your agency in terms of where that role should originate at. I do have to say it's a lot easier for an ADA or an accessibility coordinator to implement the self-evaluation and transition plan when they have experience, or especially personal experience, with disability. You know, it's a joke I've used over the last 20 plus years. How did you get to be an ADA coordinator? Because nobody ever went to school to sit there, or when they were 5 or 6 years old, did anybody ever ask you, hey, what do you want to be when you grow up? And no one ever answers, hey, I want to be an ADA coordinator. Usually being an ADA coordinator is because there was a meeting that happened that you either didn't get invited to, or you had left the room for a couple minutes and everybody kind of voted on you to be the ADA coordinator, or it's number 28 on your job description, other duties as assigned. But in all practicality, it's a lot easier when the ADA coordinator has experience or personal experience with disability, because to some extent, it's a balancing act to between being a compliance manager, complying with the implementation of the ADA within your organization, and also being a disability advocate to making sure that those policies, practices, and procedures are modified and people with disabilities can fully participate in your services. So in my approach over the past 20 plus odd years, is that I really think that accessibility management and ADA compliance is everyone's responsibility. It takes a similar approach as safety or risk management, where you might have one central coordinating person like a safety manager or a risk coordinator, but safety and risk management is really everybody's responsibility. Same thing with ADA compliance, where you would have a central coordinating person, that ADA coordinator, but ADA compliance really needs to take place in every department across the agency. Operations, human resources, legal, finance, purchasing, IT, community outreach, facilities management, the whole gamut. So we really have to look at for ADA compliance to be successful to make sure that each department head in those areas understands what their individual responsibilities are for ADA compliance. So a few years ago, while I was working on my master's, I was looking at change agents and change in organizations, and how does this happen, and how can that parallel an approach for implementing an accessibility management program, or in terms of complying with the ADA. And so in looking at the different processes that existed, I kind of put together this overlay here for change to happen within the organization. And for ADA coordinators, it's a lot easier for direction to come from the top leadership in terms of a commitment to inclusion and to provide staff with direction. You know, this is our purpose and we're going to make sure that everything that we do is accessible and inclusive of people with disabilities. And so the model that I've presented here is a similar approach to change management, where the business purpose and mission are defined, shared values are clarified, responsibilities are delegated, information is gathered, consensus is built, and then the process is evaluated to determine how can we make this work better. And so in following that model, again, the leadership team would make its commitment to inclusion and provide direction to the staff. The accessibility coordinator is assigned to oversee accessibility management program. An access team is formed with representatives from various departments and units. An accessibility assessment is conducted for facilities and programs. Regular meetings are scheduled to prioritize projects with input from the access team and visitors or users or the general public. Implementation of the accessibility improvements are made, and then you're always, again, evaluating and looking at how those improvements can be better in the future, and then reporting back to leadership and other stakeholders. And so, you know, I would urge you, if you feel like you're a one-person show in terms of ADA compliance in your agency, of looking at how you can get buy-in from leadership and bring other people into the team to make it more effective as you work forward with both your self-evaluation and your transition plan. And so for the purpose of this conversation and some articles that I've been writing and presenting on, I like that there are a lot of agencies out there that have put together job responsibilities for ADA coordinators, but nobody has really done anything in terms of all of the other functions within the agency. So I tried to bring all these together with kind of the different departments in terms of the accessibility management team. So you have your designated responsible employee that is likely your CEO. You have your ADA coordinator that is responsible for managing daily ADA compliance. And then you have your engineering, design, or planning team that prioritizes and implements accessibility improvements that are identified in the ADA transition plan. Operations or public works, their responsibility is to make ADA improvements through routine maintenance and ensure daily facility access. Where you provide programs and services, the reasonable modifications, auxiliary aids and services are provided in the most integrated setting. Certainly marketing and communication are key to making sure that any information or messages that you're sending out to the public are effectively communicated in terms of your program services and activities. And purchasing plays a key role to make sure that your new products, services, and contracts include ADA compliance. Information technology, another big one again, to ensure that any new technologies that you're using for the public, employees, and volunteers are accessible. Human resources and their role to facilitate reasonable accommodations for applicants, employees, and volunteers. Legal and finance, they certainly play a key role in serving as resources to the agency on compliance. And then the risk manager also to assess the safety concerns related to ADA compliance. And so I kind of try to put those together in a nutshell. Certainly each agency is different, and if there are other unique areas that you think should be included there, please feel free to send me an email, and I'd be happy to try to figure out how to work those in there. So, again, using more of a team approach, recognizing that the ADA coordinator can't be all in all places at all times, that you really need to have an accessibility management team for successful compliance. The responsibility for that team, you know, when I work with a lot of different agencies, we try to say at the beginning, especially with getting the transition plan up and running, to meet a minimum of quarterly to review projects and implementation, to provide updates on implementation in each unit and department, to help guide the ADA policy development, and to serve as a liaison with the disability advocacy groups in the community. So I have two agencies right now that they've actually developed charters, organizational charters for their accessibility management team that explains how people get assigned to the management team, how often it meets, what its responsibilities are, what the desired outcomes are. And so that's a big deal for each of those agencies because it more formally recognizes the accessibility management team. And I think it makes a huge statement to the public and the community of people with disabilities on the commitment for that agency. So if we talk a little bit about the ADA or 504 self-evaluation. So you may have done this. You may think that you did it, or that's okay, you might not have ever done it before within your agency. Even if you did it when you were required to do it way back in the early 1990s, I think it's a really good idea to revisit it every few years And the reason that I say that is that if you look at the average individual is in their position for 7 years. Over the course of the last 27 years, that means we've had at least 3 or 4 generations of staff come and go in an organization. And so policies that might have been originally modified to be made accessible to make sure people with disabilities could fully participate. I've seen a lot of policies that were changed and in essence made less accessible than they were originally changed back in the 1990s. So, and there's a lot of historical data that is lost when you have that attrition within an organization. So I think that it's a good practice to go back every 7 to 10 years and review your policies rather than just saying, oh yeah, we did that way back in 1992 when we were supposed to, we're good to go. Plus you have a lot of new policies that have been developed over the years, and it's just a good practice. But what we want to do is make sure we have conducted a comprehensive review of policies, practices, and procedures that we've identified where there are issues of non-compliance or in policies and practices and what we might need to do in terms of modifying those policies and practices to bring them into compliance. We need to give an opportunity for people with disabilities and other interested parties to review and comment, and we should keep that on public inspection. And what I like to do is use an approach similar to an ADA action plan, which is much more of an umbrella. I have an organization that I'm working with right now, and they asked me to come in first as just a technical writer to write an action plan for me or for the organization. But when I met with the CEO, he sat down and he said, I want this to be our inclusion manifesto. I want any new staff and all of our old staff to be able to pick up this document and read about our commitment to inclusion of people with disabilities in everything we do, from employment to every single program, service, or activity that we operate. That there's no doubt our commitment to inclusion of people with disabilities and to the practice of universal design. And so I thought that was a really interesting approach because it wasn't just about meeting the minimum in terms of compliance, but really putting it out there of what this agency believed in terms of making sure people with disabilities were included. And following that kind of action plan approach, the Institute for Human-Centered Design kind of reworked that early document, the ADA Title II Action Guide for State and Local Governments, and that was used to be one of my go-to resources. That is a fantastic book if you have one of the older copies there, but they basically reworked the whole process and put it into a website. And so if you have the opportunity to go take a look at it, they've condensed everything to 7 steps, created a lot of sample forms that you can use. And so I think that it's a really great resource for people to draw on. But so they basically look at taking the self-evaluation as one step, the transition plan as another, and then developing an umbrella action plan for the entire agency to understand what different roles, responsibilities, and tasks are involved for ADA compliance. So definitely go take a look at that when you have the chance. So a lot of times when I'm working with different organizations, then we have to look at what's the best approach to review these policies, practices, and procedures. And so essentially what I recommend is that you're looking at pretty much everything and you're asking the question, does the practice, policy, or procedure screen out or prohibit individuals with disabilities from participating in and enjoying the benefits of the program, service, or activity? And you can use, an easy checkbox approach by either no action is required, action is required for ADA compliance, or there's action recommended as the best practice of access for people with disabilities. So that's a very simple approach to take in basically looking at all of those different policies, practices, and procedures. And so in part of that process, we need to recognize that you have to do some kind of document scan. You might not be able to scan every single solitary document in the organization, but if you could get your hands on a broad cross-section of those documents that your agency uses to basically direct the way that you do business, it'll help you a lot in the process. So when I'm working with an organization, I'll put out a list of different types of documents that we're looking for, and this is kind of a quick check here. So organizational and department procedure manuals, brochures for city program services or activities, any rules or regulations that are specific to services within a department or a unit, employment applications, employee handbook, if you have an emergency preparedness plan, if you have licensing criteria and applications or special use permits or waivers and release forms, of course, sample meetings and other public notices, if you have a complaint form or if maybe you already do have an ADA grievance form, and then any other procedures that might be specific to a department or a unit in terms of people with disabilities being able to request auxiliary aids or services. And so you kind of really want to get a broad spectrum of documents so that you can go through each of those documents and evaluate how that policy or procedure may already be compliant or you might need to make adjustments. And then I think that it's absolutely critical to conduct interviews with the key personnel across all departments and units. So a lot of times I'll be working with an agency and I'll say, okay, I want to meet with IT, risk management, marketing, and they'll say, well, why do you want to meet with those people? They don't have ADA compliance responsibilities. And I'll say, yeah, indirectly they do. If marketing is putting out a poster about, you know, a movie in the parks event, have they indicated that the poster or information on the event is available upon request, or how do people know if they need a sign language interpreter or real-time captioning for the event? How do they know that they can make that type of request? So a lot of times the interviews not only become important for the team that is conducting the interview to collect that data, it also becomes a learning opportunity with those key personnel on issues that they might not have ever thought of. It's an opportunity to give more information on how we might be able to improve this process. So looking at what are the functions across the different departments, how does the department interface with the public, and then what other policies or procedures might affect how residents or visitors receive the services. So I put some more questions that you could go about asking, and I think that the ADA Action Guide has some similar ones. They're a different in some instances, but I would recommend looking at both this PowerPoint and the ADA Action Guide for more examples of questions to ask. So say, for example, with your notice to the public, do you have a notice to the public? How is it communicated? Is it made available on more than just the website? I've included some examples here. You can go look to Cleveland Metro Parks, or I think the city of Milwaukee, Becky Rabatin, she's done a fantastic job there. She did a web scan and basically looked at municipalities across the country and what their notice to the public included, and then she brought together all the best elements of those. And so I like to just point to Becky's example and say, hey, you know, instead of just reinventing the mousetrap, just take a good look at this example, because it's really a great example. And then I've done a lot of work with the National Park Service over the years, and so they actually worked a couple of years ago at putting together a poster in terms of your rights as a person with a disability that is hung up in all national parks, and I'll show you that one in a second. This is just an example from the city of Eugene, Oregon, and their notice to the public that as a best practice, the city of Eugene values and strives to provide universal access to buildings, programs, and events. And then they go on to give examples of the different types of services that can be provided and how you can go about making a request for any type of disability-related need. And then this is, again, the example from the National Park Service that they wanted to make sure that people with disabilities were informed of their rights under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. And so I use this example all the time for entities on different ways of putting that notice out rather than just putting it on your website, but you could create a poster like this and make sure that it's hanging in all of your facilities where programs and services are conducted. And then I really like this one too from the City of San Francisco Mayor's Office on Disability. They have a similar type approach to the National Park Service poster. Would you like help with access to our services? Please let us know. And then they also give examples of wheelchair access, disability sensitivity, real-time captioning, PTY machines, assistive listening devices, sign language, braille, information and help, large print and amplified phones, and then the contact information. Then more questions about that designated official. Who is the designated official? Do they even know they're the designated official? Interestingly enough, I had a situation with an organization that everybody thought one person in particular was the designated official, and then turns out that wasn't really the person that the CEO had intended to be the designated official. So it's important to have those conversations and make sure that everybody's on the same page. And that is it different from the ADA coordinator? Should there be different context for different program services or activities? I had one entity that the ADA coordinator was in facilities and operations, and because they already had that template notice to contact this person if you had any questions, program staff just started automatically using that sentence in all of their program brochures. So requests for sign language interpreters or one-on-one inclusion staff was going to this person in facilities and operations, and it probably should have been going to the program coordinators directly. So you'll want to make sure to differentiate where are those general notices made, and then does it need to be more specific for different programs or services? And then what's your grievance procedure? How can an individual with a disability make an inquiry? When should they expect to receive a response? You know, what are the time frames involved? What can the individual do if they don't agree with a response? Is there an appeal process? So those are all questions to ask as you're reviewing a grievance procedure. And then how are you getting input from people with disabilities? Is this an ongoing process? Is it a one-time deal? You know, I have another organization right now that they're looking at doing a lot of different approaches to getting input from people with disabilities, not just having a public hearing, but including different open houses at their different facilities, conducting a survey amongst the community members, and then they're actually looking at conducting focus groups with people that are invited from different disability organizations so that they can drill down to more specific approaches to inclusion for those different disability groups. So you might need to look at a multifaceted approach to getting input from people with disabilities. How can people with disabilities ask for auxiliary aids and services? Is that a centralized process or a decentralized process? I cannot emphasize enough the importance to know where to tap into the auxiliary aids and services before you get the request. You know, are there sign language interpreters available in your area? Do you need to put a contract or an agreement into place? What about real-time captioners, maybe even live audio description or verbal description. That's a growing area for people with visual impairments to make those types of requests. So do you know where those resources are when you might receive that request, and is it necessary to actually have some type of agreement in place so that you can get in touch with those service providers? Then alternate formats. This is getting, as technology evolves, it's a lot easier than it used to be in terms of providing different types of alternate formats, but making sure that you've communicated the availability to people with disabilities on the alternate formats. Again, asking how are you going to do it? Is it going to be a centralized or a decentralized process? And are staff trained to intake the process? So if somebody asks for, you know, calls up and asks for your annual report in either large print or braille, are staff prepared to take that request, or are they going to just say, no, I'm sorry, that's not available? But making sure that staff are trained is going to be key on that. Then looking at different types of forms and making sure that you're not asking disability inquiries that might be too invasive. How do you ask those questions? Are you asking for waivers? Is it consistent with business necessity? And eligibility criteria, I'm going to kind of fly through these pretty quickly so that we can talk more about the transition plan. Obviously, service animals, that's another area that you're going to want to look at. What are your policies? I have a lot of cities that have ordinances for animals to be on leashes. They even have a municipality that does not allow any pets in their parks. And so we've looked at how do those ordinances need to be modified to enable service animals to be available to the people with disabilities that they serve. Of course, other power-driven mobility devices, same types of questions there. And then looking at what types of modifications need to be put into place. Is it something that you might have to evaluate an issue on a case-by-case basis? And what is that process? Is it a centralized or a decentralized approach? Are staff trained on disability and ADA compliance? How are you actually documenting this process, and how are you evaluating it after the reasonable modification has been put into place? Making sure that you're clear with your contracts and partnerships. Of a municipality right now that they leased a property to a historical society, and the historical society has a lot more work to do in terms of making sure that the programs that they're holding are actually accessible. And so in part of that process is reevaluating that contract agreement and spelling out specifically what's their responsibility for the municipality, and then what will be the responsibility for the historic society. So we want to always make sure when we have those opportunities to renegotiate contracts or partnerships that we take that time to clarify roles and expectations. And then safety, how do you address safety concerns? Is the risk manager included? Is the assessment documented? Do you have that on file to make sure that people understand why you either enabled the person to participate, or why, because of safety, the modification was not put into place? And then this goes along those same lines. When you have to say no, is the designated official involved in the determination? If you do deny that request, what is the explanation? What was the process for assessment, and what is the rationale? And a lot of times they call that the CYA documentation, but you really have to have that documentation put into place in the event that you were to have a complaint, that you can go back to the documentation and say, well, this is how we came to this decision, and making sure that that designated official is involved in the process. And then we get to that action plan, or what are the policies and procedures that need to be modified, who is responsible in each department, if there are any costs associated. And I would recommend that you go back to that ADA action guide to the seventh step. They actually have a format for a table to put those action steps into a good format, and then you can distribute that with your accessibility or your ADA management team. So everybody knows what their responsibilities are, what your key timelines are, and who needs to be doing what. So then switching gears, so up to this point, we really focus on policies and procedures. Well, we can't deny that there are facilities, support facilities, where the programs and services happen that probably still have some type of physical barrier that needs to be removed in order to make sure that people with disabilities can fully access those programs and services. And so recognize that, you know, in a municipality, I do a lot of work with park and recreation agencies, and I tell them all the time, you could have 100 parks that, or 100 facilities that are not accessible and that you don't have any plan to make accessible, but your responsibility is to meet the program access standard so that whatever the services, programs, activities that you provide, people with disabilities are able to use those services and programs or activities and participate and get the same benefits that people without disabilities get. So the program access standard is really our guiding regulation behind the implementation of our transition plan. So what we're looking at when viewed in its entirety is that program, service, or activity readily accessible to and usable by people with disabilities. So I always ask people, what is the purpose of this facility? Why do people come here? And dealing with so many parks, I ask people, well, why do people come here? If your staff knew that a person only had 20 minutes to spend in this site, what is it they're coming? What is it that they should see? What is it that they should experience in order to truly have the same experience as people without disabilities? And then that's the area that we need to focus in figuring out how to make that accessible to people with disabilities. Sometimes that might mean relocating to an accessible facility, maybe providing those same types of benefits in an alternative accessible site. More often than not, it means making structural changes to an existing site and giving priority to the methods that facilitate the most integrated settings. And so that's where we're looking at this model. Existing facilities applying the program access standard, that is what gets us to the priorities within our transition plan. And so your transition plan is required if you are an entity that has 50 or more entities and that you are required to put that together by July 26, 1992 and have all of your barriers removed by January 26, 1995. Now, I know because I work a lot in park and recreation is that we didn't even have enforceable standards for what an accessible swimming pool or golf course or fishing pier or boating facility even looked like until 2010. And so because the standards continue to evolve, this is yet another reason to go back and revisit that transition plan to make sure that those supporting facilities for your program, services, and activities are addressing and are in compliant with the most current standards wherever and hopefully most practicable. So the transition plan, where we need to make those structural changes to existing facilities, the regulations actually say that we should identify the physical or communication barriers to the programs, goods, or services, the identification of a solution for barrier removal, It should have a prioritization and targeted timeline for barrier removal and assigned responsibility. And then that transition plan is actually supposed to be on public, available for the public at any point until such time that the transition plan has been fully implemented or all of the corrective actions have been made. So when you're looking at, we look at assessing your facility and looking at when viewed in its entirety, can people with disabilities get the opportunity to participate and benefit from the program? And so the transition plan itself requires data collection to start with. Some of my colleagues in the field, it's kind of like the difference between tomato and tomato. The colleagues in the field will call it an accessibility assessment, a survey, or an audit. My preference is to call it an accessibility assessment or a survey. I don't like calling it an audit because if you've ever been audited, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't really convey a lot of positive feelings there. So I kind of stray away from the audit terminology. But if you are looking at conducting that assessment or survey, going out and doing basically an inspection or an assessment and identifying where those physical and communication barriers are. When I go out, the methodology that I use is to follow the sequence that is used by the visitor or the public in considering the different needs of those different populations. For people with mobility impairments, visual impairments, hearing impairments, cognitive impairments. But recognizing that when you're doing the assessment or the survey, it's a snapshot in time. It is how that building or facility looked on the day that you went out to collect the data. And I had one project that it was a very eccentric landowner, and he was giving the land to the state DNR, and so we went out there to do an assessment over the course of several weeks, and every time we showed up, he had done something different. He had either built a new building or renovated something, and so it looked completely different from the previous visit when we had just assessed it, and so that's when we kind of had to put the line in the sand to say, okay, this is how it looked on the day that we were here and collected the data. So recognize that if it takes you a couple of years in your transition plan, it's going to require you to go back and visit that site, especially, you know, there are a lot of different reasons that we make alterations. Maybe you had some vandalism that happened at a facility, or maybe you had some storm damage. So recognizing that there is a need to go back and making sure that our corrective actions that we have identified are appropriate still for that initial data that was collected. Applying the 2010 ADA standards and then any other proposed standards or guidelines, looking at how you can apply the principles of universal design and other best practices, and then making sure that the assessment includes recommendations for barrier removal. So when I work at going out and doing the assessment, I help the client by categorizing the barrier to the program service or activity. And I have some clients that will ask for a 3-point scale or a 4-point scale or a 5-point scale, and then we clearly define each of those priority points. And so this is just an example of a project where we did a 4-point scale. So the priorities were either categorized as critical, serious, moderate, or minor. And so the example for critical is it's an outdoor amphitheater. There's no accessible route to the outdoor amphitheater. There's no wheelchair accessible seating. There's no assistive listening system. And so those are all things that are barriers to participation by the individuals with disabilities. The second one there, that serious one, that's an entrance into a visitor center. There's no automatic door opener. However, it doesn't necessarily prohibit an individual from using the visitor center. It's certainly uncomfortable. It might require some help, or assistance to get in, but it's obviously different from there not being any accessible entrance there whatsoever. The third category, that moderate categorization, that's an element that exists. It might be still usable, but isn't really part of the program service or experience. It might be more of an amenity. And then for this particular project, we categorized a fourth priority, a minor one, where the element may have met the previous accessibility standards, but it doesn't meet the new one. So if it's altered in the future, we wanted to make a note of that for the facility owner so that they could update that and make sure it was more consistent with the current standards. And so when we do the categorization of priorities, we want to make sure that it's simply giving a frame or a structure to the agency or to the building owner or the organization on how the priority affects the magnitude by which people with disabilities can either experience or not experience the program or activity. The priority is that, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, or critical, serious, moderate, minor, they don't dictate the order by which the corrective actions are made. And a lot of times, those critical priorities actually take longer time for planning and implementation, but they simply give more of a framework to the agency to help them with their transition planning. So rather than having, you know, a list of 100 deficiencies for a site or a facility, the agency can, in their transition planning, pull out all of the critical, all of the serious, and then help kind of have a better understanding of where they need to put their focus at to make sure that people with disabilities can eventually get to the program services and activities. So just kind of a difference here between the assessment or the survey report and the transition plan. So the assessment or survey report includes identification of the physical or communication barriers and recommendations for barrier removal. Then the transition plan, in addition to those two, should also have a targeted timeline for barrier removal. It should identify the person or their responsible unit. It should include what you might do in lieu of barrier removal, and then documentation of the corrective action. For those entities that have a really long laundry list of corrective actions that need to be made, I think it's a very good idea to keep documentation about what corrective actions have been done, when they were completed, and what the cost was, so that at any point in time you could report that information back to the public, or should you have any type of formal inquiry or a complaint. So this is just kind of one example from one agency that had, they had about 1,000 work orders to remove deficiencies or barriers for people with disabilities, and about 20% of those fell into that critical priority, but more of them than any fell into the serious, that they were somewhat usable, but not entirely compliant with the standards. So when viewed in its entirety, they probably could still get to the area or the program or service, but the barrier still affected their enjoyment of it. And then some of the most frequently cited recommendations that we come across, providing, you know, this is just for Parks and Rec as an example, providing picnic areas that are accessible, adjusting opening forces for doors, making modifications to pathways, restroom identification sign. I tell you, more often than not, we see restroom signs that are not accessible, that they don't have the raised characters in Braille, or that they're on the door or not put in the appropriate location. Striping accessible parking spaces and access aisles, that's always a frequently cited one. Insulation on lavatory pipes, coat racks within, or coat hooks in the accessible stall within the reach range, that drinking fountain, making sure that there's not just the low wheelchair accessible unit, but there's also the higher standing unit, and fire rings and grills. And so that we like to kind of give an idea of how much all those different costs are, so an agency has a good idea of what type of budgeting they need to put together for future planning. And then looking at all the different factors for scheduling barrier removal, you know, if you're an entity that has several facilities, what's the location of those facilities, what kind of use, what's the volume of visitors or the public, what's the master plan for the facility? Is there any type of duplicative program or service that happens nearby that you might be able to say, in an interim process, this is our designated accessible location, and really focus on providing more of those programs and services at the accessible location until which time you can make the other site more accessible. And also recognizing that transition planning, that it feels like you're not ever done. It's an ongoing process. What you have identified as your priorities today, you could get a complaint tomorrow and your priorities completely change in order to address the nature of that complaint. So recognizing that your transition plan, the ink on it is probably never really dry, but it needs to be a dynamic working document, and you keep working away on it. You're including the accessibility management team. You're making it available for public inspections, and you're engaging people with disabilities throughout the process. And so that, and I like to see that kind of annual, when you have your ADA celebration in July, I think that's a really great opportunity to have an open house specific to your ADA transition plan and to showcase these are all of the accessibility improvements that we've made over the course of the last year to make sure that the public knows what those are, and then to also ask questions of the public. This is what we're looking at doing for the next 2 or 5 years or whatever it might be, and getting more input from people with disabilities and disability advocacy organizations. And so I think that piggybacking on the ADA celebrations is a really good opportunity to get more community engagement from people with disabilities. So if there's anything that you can do right now, and if I give you homework, I would ask you to put together an accessibility management team. Go find your original ADA self-evaluation. Do you know where it is? Do you know where your original ADA transition plan is? If you don't know where either one of those two documents are, it probably means you need to get started on them. And also look at establishing a relationship with people with disabilities and engaging the community. And I always tell people it's a lot easier to do this from the top down. So if you can get the commitment from senior leadership, that speaks volumes in and of itself, and making sure that senior leadership gives that direction to staff that your organization is committed to inclusion and ADA compliance, that it's going to be part of your organizational culture. So from that, Robin, I think if we have time to take some questions, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Well, thank you very much for a lot of information provided to us in a fairly short period of time, but it's obviously packed with a lot of content. I know that you just went over to your contact information here as well, which is on the front slide, but also is available to you here for those of you who may want to follow up with Jennifer following the session. But this is your chance to ask some questions. So let me just start with Tia on the telephone, and Chanel, are there any questions that anybody has on the telephone before we start taking some from the webinar platform?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star then the one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. To prevent any background noise, we ask that you please place your line on mute once your question has been stated. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, that's star one to ask a question at this time.
Okay, while we're waiting for people to queue up there, we do have a question here that was submitted by through the webinar platform. One is, why would you suggest an automatic door opener is required if the force to open that door is under 8 pounds? There's no requirement, correct?
Well, that depends on your state. So your state, right, Robin, has a requirement for the 8 pound force.
Correct.
We have both an interior. We have both an interior and exterior door opening force.
Yeah.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Right. So my state does not have an 8 pound force requirement. So we try to, when we're going out, model the other states and get to that 7 or 8 pounds. But we have way more situations than not that we can actually get down to 8 pounds. And so in those instances, we would recommend an automatic door for a front entrance and most likely for a secondary entrance, depending on what the makeup of the facility was.
Okay. So also you would look at, I would assume, Jennifer, from a program access perspective, you might be looking at automatic doors as a solution to a barrier to, you know, access for a select or a specific group of people, too, specific training
exactly.
Program you might be
mm-hmm.
offering. Yes.
Yeah.
So it goes beyond just the architectural access, but also that need to look at part of your self-evaluation, the program access issues as well, correct?
Yep.
So someone says everything that they're reading about door force is that it's 5 pounds. Is that interior only? Maybe you want to clarify the requirements for interior-exterior doors.
So the requirement 2010 ADA standards is only for interior doors being 5 pounds. And then the exterior doors reflects back to your local state, your state or local authority. Some state or local authorities have adopted more stringent standards. Like I said, the state of Illinois has a more stringent standard. The neighboring state that I'm in Indiana, does not have that same requirement. So that's where we kind of look at, in the absence of having a standard, I got to figure out programmatically how I can make that entrance accessible when I know a 15-pound door is too difficult for a lot of people, both ambulatory or users of different assistive devices to use. And so the practicality of it is that if I can't adjust the door closer, the tension on the door closer and those three magic screws, that door could be too heavy, and in all practicalness, the next best solution is going to be an automatic door.
Great. And do you have a suggestion for where people might be able to, if they're not familiar with their states, a website or something that they could go to where might give a link to the various states' codes and requirements and such, or
yeah.
For them,
so,
as to how they might do that?
I don't have the link right off the top of my head. So you can actually go to the International Code Council website. I think it's icc.org, right, Robin?
Correct.
And mm-hmm. you can do a search right in there for accessibility codes. And they do have a link that has a ginormous list of every single state accessibility code, if they have one.
Right, because not some. There are some states that do not have accessibility
correct.
Codes. Yes. Correct.
Or yes. There's other states that they're as old as dirt, like Indiana, and they haven't been updated.
Right. That's something that we do deal with, for sure. We have someone who's asking if you could just clarify for them what's the difference between, or how is a public versus a private entity differ?
That's a good question. So a Title II entity, a public entity, a unit of state or local government was required to have all of those administrative requirements, the notice to the public, the designated responsible employee, the self-evaluation, the transition plan, depending on the size, and the grievance procedure. Title III entities are basically private businesses that opened up and make goods and services available to the public. They were not required to do a self-evaluation or a transition plan. However, I think it's a pretty good best practice to follow if you are a Title III entity. In fact, I'm working with a museum right now, which is covered under Title III. However, they receive federal grants, which basically means that they are required to follow Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. And so they have taken the approach that we want to comply with both Section 504 and the ADA Title III, and so they have gone about completing an ADA action plan that brings together a self-evaluation and a transition plan.
Great. Yeah, I think it's best practice also to think that we've seen where complaints and things that have been filed against Title III entities, one of the defenses that may be used or could be useful to an entity is to demonstrate that they had done a review of their barriers and had a plan in place that they were moving proactively forward on, even if they might still have some barriers in place and haven't achieved all of them, that a good faith effort goes a long way.
Absolutely.
Right. So in the same vein or in the talking about the fact that obviously you come from a role as a consultant and such of that nature, someone here is asking about where can they find or how do you certify an access expert? And I don't know if you have some opinions on that whole issue. There's a lot of controversy out there around this whole issue. If you've got some thoughts you could share in a neutral way with the group.
Working in this field, both with organizations that, nonprofit or university organizations that provided training and technical assistance, and then as a private consultant, in either position, I always have my flashing red lights go off when anybody ever calls themselves an expert on ADA. And I'll tell you that over the course of 20 plus odd years, I've only ever really met probably two experts on the ADA. One is one of the people at the Access Board that has written a good portion of the standards. And the other one is the moderator for this call, that taught me everything that I know. So if anybody else ever says that they're an ADA expert, I kind of like take that with a grain of salt. And the reason that I say that is that there are so many nuances to the ADA. There's so much to learn. And even with the standards themselves and the regulations, if you don't read those every day and work with them every day, there are just unique situations that come up all the time that it's just not safe to take the word of one person or another. I mean, you can even say that 20 plus odd years later, if there's a question that I haven't come across, I am on the phone to my colleagues in the field and saying, let's talk this through. On the flip side of that, that's not to say that you can't become very well versed in the ADA. And first and foremost, I would always recommend the National ADA Symposium as one of the best training and professional education places to start with, and attending that annual conference. It's the best collection of people with ADA compliance responsibilities from across the nation coming together at one event, and then also looking to the ADA coordinator training program or certificate that is offered through the ADA Symposium or the Great Lakes ADA or the Great Plains ADA Center. So those are probably the two.
Yeah, and I think best practice is anything. I mean, take ADA or anything out of it, is that when you're looking to hire somebody to do work for you, you want to know what their references are. You want to know, what other work have they done, and what has been the result of that work. So if you've got somebody out there who's telling you that they're an ADA expert or they're holding themselves out as such, then one of the things that you want to find out is, well, what have you done and what work have you done? Let me follow up with the people that you've done the work with to find out what their experiences have been. So it's, there is no official, federal designation as an ADA expert or an ADA certified anything. There are, as Jennifer identified, a certificate program available where someone can. And then in different states, there are state laws that identify or provide designation for people to be certified accessibility specialists. CASP, C-A-S-P, is one of the designations that's used. I think Texas, California have these programs as part of their state where people have had to go through additional training to demonstrate knowledge on the ADA and the standards and the local and state codes and things like that. Definitely, you want to do due diligence if you're looking at that issue of, ADA experts. There are a lot of people out there who are doing this work. Some are doing very good work. Just fire beware.
If I could piggyback on that, I have a lot of agencies that ask, is this something that we could do internally or should we hire a consultant for it? And I think that is just a different question for every agency. I've had some agencies that have said, can you come in and train us on how to do the assessment process? I just did that a year ago with Cleveland Metro Parks. They dedicated 100 of their staff to receiving more than 32 hours of training, which was huge for them. And then we trained them on the ADA soup to nuts, and then we did more specific training for their planners on how to do the assessment. So they had a team of 7 planners that have spent the last year going out and assessing each of their sites, and their sites are that their ADA transition plan is now complementary to each of those sites' master plans, which when they published the final document, I'm hugely proud of the work that they've done to be able to go out and do that. On the flip side of it, I've had other agencies that once they figure out how much staff time that is, that they're like, there's no way we could dedicate that much staff time out of the office to go do this. It would just be easier to hire a consultant. But what I will say if I'm hiring a consultant is go talk to other consultants in the field before you even issue an RFP. Don't just Google an RFP and find and replace their organization name with yours, because there's some really bad ones out there and you can get not very good results from copying and pasting like that. I'll also say that just hiring an engineering firm or an architectural firm to do an assessment could result in overpaying for an assessment or a transition plan. In a transition plan itself, this is my personal opinion, is I do not think that it's the consultant's responsibility to put together the schedule. It has to be the agency's responsibility because it's the agency's plan. So I don't think that it's realistic to ask a consultant to, come up with a 5-year plan. What should we do first, second, and third? The agency is what knows best, what its priorities should be. So I would say the most that if you were to look to a consultant or a third party to have them do the assessment process, but that you put together the transition plan or work together with a consultant to put together the transition plan. I'm sure I just really ticked a lot of people off by everything that I just said there. But go talk to people. I mean, we're out here. We're happy to talk to you, because we, ultimately, I like to work with the organizations that they want to do this. They want to revisit it, not because it's the law, but because it's the right thing to do. You don't have to hire me. I have plenty of work to do right now, but I want to see that you get the best product. And so when I see that an agency publishes their self-evaluation and transition plan and that they paid a consultant big bucks and, you know, the plan is 180 pages, but only 20 pages of it actually deal with the self-evaluation and the transition plan, and the rest of the 100 pages are the ADA, the regulations and the standards. Like, that was a consultant that overcharged you to copy and paste the regulations. And I've seen dozens of those types of plans out there that there's more, that they've done more copying and pasting of the regulations and the standards than actually gave the agency the meat and potatoes of what they need to do for an action plan.
Good advice. Somebody's asking a question on whether or not, are you familiar with any kind of price ranging or documents that give some kind of preliminary cost of what various types of accessibility items would cost in a survey?
Yes. So the one that a lot of people still fall back to, and it's the only document that's out there, and I wish that somebody would take it upon themselves to work to revise it, is the RS Means ADA Compliance Pricing Guide. It was only last updated in 2004, but it has, I have it right down here. I have so many pages of it. It has hundreds of the most, I shouldn't say hundreds, probably it breaks it into chapters between entrances and curb cuts and plumbing fixtures and that, but it has those most frequent cited corrective actions, and it breaks down what the material cost for those corrective actions would be. You'll have to do more adjustment though for inflation and the labor rate in your area, but it's a good starting place to get you started.
Great. Good resource. Here's a question for you. For a government entity that awards grants to other government entities, such as cities, counties, park agencies, transportation providers, what is that entity's responsibility for ensuring that its grantees are currently complying with the ADA? Do you have any suggestions or thoughts on that?
So
this
that's
will be
a really good
month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. So we've had a lot of granting agencies like that in their annual award, that the criteria includes giving an update on what their ADA compliance work has been. If the agency were just funding for specific projects, for any type of agency to do that, I don't think it's a good idea to do that without seeing the actual plans and doing a site visit once the project has been completed before the project is actually signed off on. I've done a lot of work with different DNRs that they distribute the land and water conservation funds to municipalities for those different types of projects. And I just always think that it's a really good idea to see the actual plans ahead of time, provide technical assistance if needed, but make sure that the design review includes accessibility on it and that a site visit is done before the final check is signed and given over to the grantee to make sure it's in compliance. There's just too many new projects out there that are still not being done, that are not fully compliant. I mean, just last week, we went to a new park. It's less than a year old. It has a new restroom building. It only has one drinking fountain, and the knee clearance, it was installed at 25 inches knee clearance. So it's still really possible to not do it correctly.
Right. That follow-up that is really critically important after installation, for sure. Question here from, do state accessibility codes override federal code or vice versa?
Well, it depends. I don't even know how I want to answer that one. So I don't really know how I want to answer this today. So some states and municipalities have adopted more current versions of the International Building Code, which are becoming more stringent. So I think the DOJ position is that wherever you use a standard, you're supposed to use the entirety of the standard and not just pick and choose the places that you like. That used to be the issue between picking UFAS and the old ADAG. So if you're picking your state code that is, has more stringent, you should, if all of those other areas are at least consistent with the 2010 ADA standards, you should probably be using your state code. But it all depends on where the complaint comes from. And I'm sure there's other people that would like to answer that differently. If you'd like to answer that, that's fine with me. But I think you have to look at what the which one is the more stringent. Like right now, the new standard, the new International Building Code standard requires the vertical grab bar in the toilet stall. So if that is what your state code is using, that's probably what you should be looking to as well.
Correct. I mean, typically you look at the, you know, which provides the greater degree of access for for individuals. You can't, you know, cannot go left, but you can always go higher.
Yep.
With your accessibility for sure.
We did all that harmonization between the building codes and the ADA, and now we're all out of harmonization again.
I think that's the problem, though, ongoing with the federal level, is that there's always a lag behind the federal level with how other standards are developed because of the bureaucratic process that is development of standards. And that's why I think you see also at the federal level they're adopting more external standards as part of the ADA, such as the fire codes and things of that nature, so that we don't see the as many problems, so as things are changing or moving, that they are more best practice being utilized versus just being caught up in the regulatory process that the federal level inherently has as part of that. So we're winding down here, but what are the most frequent pitfalls when doing self-evaluation transition plans that you see that entities have? Is it their process? Is it their failure to plan or to put everything in place before they start? What are the most pitfall things that you see?
I think that the biggest pitfall is going into it with the approach or the attitude is that we're just trying to get this done to meet the law. In park and recreation agencies right now, an ADA evaluation and transition plan is required as part of the national accreditation process. And so there's different approaches, just like there were, 20 plus years ago when the ADA was passed, of that just attitude of, we just need to get this done, and then the documents get put on a shelf, and they start collecting dust, and the plans themselves, the modifications of policies and practices, the transition plan itself, they're never communicated with those key departments, and so they're not effectively implemented. And the only way to effectively implement both the self-evaluation and the transition plan is that team approach. Everybody has to be involved. Everybody has to take ownership of their areas of responsibility for it to be successful.
I agree. Someone's asking if you could just repeat the name of the pricing guide once again.
So you can get it on Amazon, but I'm sure if I Google it in the next hour, it could be out. You might be able to get a used copy of it. It's the RS Means, M-E-A-N-S, ADA Compliance Pricing Guide. So just to give you an idea, RS Means for years has done all different types of pricing guide resource documents like this for cost estimating. And so this one, they worked together with, I think that it was Adaptive Environments, I think.
Yeah, correct. Yes. That's
with
the Adaptive Environments, yeah.
Yeah, when it was Adaptive Environment, yeah, and now the Institute for Human-Centered Design. So they worked together after the ADA was passed to do one that was specific to ADA compliance. And, you know, if anybody can talk them into updating that, that would be fantastic. But RS Means ADA Compliance Pricing Guide.
Correct. I also put it into the chat area here. So again, we're at the bottom of the hour, so unfortunately we do have to conclude our session today. There's many more questions here, I think, that went unanswered, unfortunately, and it's the price of our time. But we do have Jennifer's contact information. We also strongly encourage you to be in contact with your regional ADA center, which you can access through the 800 number of 800-949-4232. That's a national phone number. Or you can visit the website at www.adata.org. That's the national website that would locate you to the center that serves your geographic area. We invite you to go join us again for the ADA Audio Conference series in November. Our topic in next month's session will be Service Animals and the ADA, Exploring Common Issues and Scenarios. This session will actually be looking at some real-life scenarios, some common questions that come up as service animals continue to be an issue that is actually more than anything else, with a lot of questions and in some situations problematic, and we're seeing more state laws start to crop up here and there trying to address some of these issues. So please consider joining us for November 21st for that particular session. At this time, we would like to once again thank Jennifer for her time today and for sharing her expertise. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. The session was recorded. We will be posting the audio as well as a transcript on our website in the upcoming days. You will receive an email related to any credit for attending today's session and an evaluation. We do appreciate your feedback following the conclusion of this session. So again, thank you everyone for joining us, and I hope you have a rest of your day, good one, as well as the rest of the week. Take care everyone, and you can now hang up the phone or close out your browser as the session is now concluded. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This concludes today's program. You may